You know, one of the strange things and maybe at times confusing things about religion, about Christianity, is that why do we have to believe that there's a God? I mean, why do we have to believe that there's this God who created us, who loves us, who wants to have a relationship with us? Why do we have to believe? Why don't we just know? And why is it so difficult at times to believe? I mean, isn't it important enough? Wouldn't you think it's important enough that we would just know these kinds of things? Like, for instance, I'm married, but I don't ever have to take by faith that I'm married. I don't sit around and go, I just believe that I'm married. I have faith that I'm married. I have kids. I don't have faith, and I don't sit around and say, God, just give me the faith that I have kids. You know, just help me believe. Sometimes you want to pray, please help me to believe. I don't have them anymore. But I mean, it's like, you know, we don't have to have faith for that, right? So why would something as critically important as God, do we have to believe? Do we have to have faith? Why can't we just know? And why is it so difficult at times to believe that there is this God that loves us and wants to have a relationship with us? Why do we have to believe? There's a, you know, when you think about the reality of where we are as people, and even in this room today, the reality is that there is a huge spectrum of different thoughts and beliefs about God and faith and religion. See, some of you are here today and you've got a lot of faith in God. There are others of you who have very little faith. Some of you are trying to regain your faith from maybe in childhood or earlier in life. Some of you feel like you've lost your faith. Some of you would say faith is nothing more than foolishness because there is no God. And so I know that the reality of even in this room today, there is a wide spectrum of different beliefs about God and about faith. And so we wanted to do this series because we want to ask this question. It's the question of the series: who needs God? Who really needs God? And do we really actually need God in our lives? See, some of you would say, yes, absolutely, but we don't always live like it, right? Some of you would say, no, we don't need God. But we have a difficult time completely dismissing him from our lives. Do we really need God? Maybe the better question that some are asking is, do we need religion? See, one time in our country, we felt like religion had answers. But today, more and more, people are feeling like religion is the problem. Religion is what's keeping everyone separated, keeping everyone at odds. Religion is really the problem. And so some would say, we don't need religion anymore. Do we really need God? And who needs God? You know, right after 9/11 happened in our country, and then the World Trade Center towers were destroyed, and the Pentagon was attacked, right after that, and I don't know, probably many of you know exactly where you were when that took place. You remember watching it, you know exactly where you were. And I know that I was up in the offices with some of the other staff, and we were watching it take place on television. And I remember thinking and commenting to the other staff that this Sunday is going to be packed. There's probably going to be more people here this Sunday than we're here at Easter. I mean, it's going to be packed this Sunday. And sure enough, we got around to Sunday, and it was almost standing room only. It was packed. And people were coming. A lot of people were coming back to church. Some people were coming to church for the very first time. And it wasn't just our church. It was churches all over the country. I mean, everything Christian or Jewish or really religious, people were just flocking to. And then the second Sunday, it was the same way, packed. And then the third Sunday, it was right back to normal. And then something else began happening that most of you probably weren't aware of, but we've all been affected by. That right after 9/11, there was this surge of anti-religious sentiment that began to spread throughout the country. And different people began, you know, voicing different things about God and religion and anti-God and anti-religious kind of things. There was a guy, a neuroscientist by the name of Sam Harris, and right after 9/11, he wrote a book that was really just a scathing review of all things religious. And here, the title of the book was The End of Faith, Religion, Terror, and the Future of Reason. He writes this book, and I mean, he went to probably a dozen publishers to get it published, and nobody wanted to publish it because, you know, it wasn't just a book against Islam, which you might expect after 9/11. It was a book against every religion. And most of the publishers were like, we're not touching that, we're not touching. He finally got someone to publish it, and it spent 33 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. Scathing rebuke of all things religion, especially Christianity, so much so that Christians began being very critical of the book and of him, which prompted him to write a second book. And the second book was entitled Letter to a Christian Nation. And in this book, he leveled the accusation right at the Christian church. He said, you're the problem. You're the problem with everything that's going on in our society and our world. Another guy by the name of Richard Dawkins wrote a book during this time, around the same time as Sam Harris. Richard Dawkins' book was entitled The God Delusion. And in this book, it wasn't so much a book about atheism as much as it was a book against all religions. And he puts forth this idea that there's, you know, there's a God delusion, that we're delusional to think there's a God. But he had an agenda, he had a goal for the entire book, and he stated it right up front. Here's what he said at the beginning of his book. He said this: if this book works as I intend, religious readers who open it will be atheists when they put it down. That his hope was that you might be religious going into this, but once I tell you the truth, you won't be religious when you put it down. You'll be atheist. And that was his goal. That was his hope. There was a journalist by the name of Christopher Hitchens. And he also came along and wrote a book during this time as well. And his book was entitled, God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. And once again, it wasn't so much a book to, you know, support atheism, but it was a book leveled right at religious and religious groups and faith and Christianity and God. Saying, God's not great. Religion is the problem. You guys are the problem. Well, these guys come out 1 or 2 years after 9/11, and they become rock stars. I mean, they are everywhere. They're on late night television. They're YouTube sensations. They're on college campuses. People are watching their debates over and over and over again. Their books are selling by the millions. In fact, the God Delusion sold 3 million people purchased the God Delusion in over 35 languages. I mean, these guys, they were everywhere. And while there wasn't this, just all of a sudden this surge of people saying, we want to be atheist, what began happening is that there began to be a large percentage of people that said, we just want to disconnect completely from religion. We don't find necessarily that atheism is all that attractive. It's just that we are less attracted to God and to religion. And so we're disconnecting. We're moving away from all things religious. In fact, it began to be such a large percentage of people that a whole category was created to identify this group of people that said, we don't want to be affiliated with any kind of religious organization or with God. And the name of the category are the nuns. Now, you have to be careful how you spell that, because you tell somebody I'm a nun and they're like, you don't look like one. I mean, so you have to be careful how you spell it. But the nuns, they are non-affiliated with any religion, with any God. It's not that they say atheism necessarily is something I want to be a part of, but it's just that I don't want to be a part of any religion or religious activity or faith in God. And kind of their whole mindset or their mantra is, we're not necessarily hostile toward religion. We just don't want to be affiliated with it. It's not that we're going to go out there and kind of get in debates with anybody, or we're not going to be anti. In fact, don't really even ask us any hard questions, because it's not like this is a well-thought-out philosophy for life. We're just done. We're done. The God that we learned about as kids, we don't want to be a part of that. In the U.S. right now, that's close to 25% of our population. About 35% of millennials. Done. Non-affiliated. I'm a nun. For some of you, that's good news. You've been non-affiliated. You didn't know you had a category. Now you're a nun. But you have to be careful how you tell that to people. But again, non-affiliated. We're not hostile. Just don't have anything to do with it. And you sit back, all right, and you see such a large gathering of people that are saying, no more. And while I can't speak for all religions, I would never pretend to do that. But I can say with a pretty good deal of certainty that when you look at the percentage of the people that are saying we no longer want to be affiliated, the overwhelming majority of them that are migrating toward this nun category, the overwhelming majority are coming from the Christian faith. They're coming out of Christianity. So millions in the last 15 years, millions of people that grew up in church, that grew up hearing the same Bible stories that many of you have heard, that know where the book of Genesis is, that heard about creation and know about Jesus and know about Adam and Eve, they know about Revelation. I mean, all these things that you might have heard of being in church. Millions of people moving from the Christian faith to saying we no longer want to be affiliated with anything religious or faith. And again, I feel like I can say with some pretty good deal of certainty that for those who have moved away from the Christian faith and they're migrating out of the Christian faith toward this non-affiliated category, I would tell you that it is the church's fault. It is our fault. It's my fault. It's those of us who call ourselves the church or Christ followers. You say, well, why would you say something like that? Well, because when I read the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, when I read the Gospel accounts and I look at the life of Jesus, there's something that's really extraordinary that begins to pop off the pages of Scripture. And here, when you look at the life of Jesus, just the life of Jesus himself, what you see pretty clearly is this. The people who are nothing like Jesus, like Jesus. I mean, the people that man, they felt far from God. They felt like, man, if this is the Son of God, we are nothing like him. Those who felt like they were nothing like Jesus absolutely liked him, liked being around him. Last week, Stuart Hall was here. He talked about how Jesus loved going to parties and how we ought to be party starters. But do you understand that the fact that Jesus liked to go to parties meant that he attended parties? And to be able to attend parties, you have to be invited to a party. And the reason you invite someone to a party is because you like them and want to be around them. You don't invite people that you don't like or that are no fun. And so Jesus liked going to parties. He liked being around people, and people liked being around him. There was something compelling. There was something so likable about Jesus that even people who felt far from God, who had so many questions about God, who felt skeptical about faith, even those people wanted to be around him. They liked him, and he liked them. And so when I back away from that, and I understand what the Scripture teaches, that for those of us who are Christ followers, we are considered the church. We are, according to the Scripture, Christ's representation on this earth. We are his body, his representation here on this earth. And if people are finding it easy to migrate away from us, if they find that we're not likable or there's nothing compelling about who we are, then I have to think that in some way we're misrepresenting who Jesus really is. We're misrepresenting him in some way. If they liked him and they don't like us, something's going on. And I think there's room to evaluate where have we contributed to this migration away from the Christian faith? And what things can we do to be the kind of people that really emulate the person and the personality of Jesus? So we have this large percentage of people that are migrating toward this non-affiliated category. And we sat back and thought, man, maybe we should do a series, and we're starting this series today, just to address some of the things that may be drawing people away, that may be causing people to be, you know, disengaged with Christianity, or maybe wanting to walk away and go in a different direction. And so today we're getting started in this direction, and I'm going to talk about atheism today. And again, I'm talking about atheism not because there's been so many people that have checked the atheist box, that's what I am, But there are so many people that are migrating away from Christianity and away from faith in God. And maybe you don't find atheism all that attractive, but you find God and faith in God less attractive. And you've migrated away. And the bottom line, and you might say, I don't even want to be an atheist. I just don't want to have anything to do with God. The bottom line and kind of a theme for today is this. You cannot move away from one thing without moving towards something else. It's just kind of a principle in life. That if you move away from one thing, you are by default moving toward something else. And so if you sit here today and you're like, I don't, God, Christianity, faith, I don't know. A lot of questions. I'm just disillusioned maybe. I don't know. I just don't want anything to do with it. I'm not wanting to be an atheist. I just don't want anything to do with God. You have to understand that by default, as you walk away from God, you are moving towards something, and it may very well be atheism. And if that's the case, what I want to do today is just try to explain a little bit about what you're moving toward. I just want you to have the information. This is not an argument for God and against atheism. I just want you to have the information, because if you're moving away from something, you're moving toward something else. And I want you to understand what it might be that you're moving toward. So I want to give you, in the last time that we have here, I want to give you what I see as six kind of tenets of atheism. So if you're here, disillusioned, you say, I don't know about God. These are the six things that you're moving toward that you have to understand. If there's no God, here's where you're moving, okay? So the tenets of this. Number one, and we call it Atheist 2.0 because the atheism that you might have known about earlier in life, it's changed. It's been upgraded, all right? There's a whole new wave of atheism, it's so better defined, and I'm going to give you the definition in just a moment. It's so better defined, and so you have to understand that it's changed. It's Atheist 2.0, okay? In fact, let me go to the definition real quick. Atheism is a complex belief system that logically leads to some unsettling conclusions. Atheism is not just, I don't believe in God. No, it's much more complex than that. It is a complex belief system like any other religion. It has all of these, if this is true, then this is true, and if this is true, then this is true. It is a complex belief system that leads to some unsettling conclusions. So as you go through, it might bring up questions or conclusions or thoughts about God and faith and religion, and they may be unsettling. But here's the truth about unsettling conclusions. Something can be unsettling, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's not true. Unsettling conclusions are not a truth test. Something can be unsettling and still be true. I'll give you some examples. Your teenage daughter's boyfriend. It's unsettling, still true. Your mother-in-law moving in with you. Unsettling. Not for me, I have a nice mother-in-law, but for some of you, unsettling. This is being recorded. Unsettling, but it's still true. See, something can be unsettling, and that doesn't necessarily mean that it's not true. So just because, the reason that's important is because some of you, and maybe you have friends or family members that have walked away from Christianity or walked away from God, because at some point, someone brought up questions or someone asked you or someone led you down a road to some conclusions that you couldn't resolve, and they were unsettling. And you decided, man, if I can't get settled on this, then it must all be, messed up. And it started crumbling. Your faith began to crumble because conclusions you arrived at were unsettling. And I'm just trying to tell you, maybe you walked away for the wrong reasons. Maybe you walked away for reasons that really have nothing to do with who Jesus is or what he represents. I've listened over the years to what we'll call deconversion stories. And these are, I've read letters, I've talked to people, I've listened to podcasts out there related to this. But these are people who at one point were Christian and they proclaimed to be Christian, and now they've said we no longer are Christians. And so they deconverted from Christianity. I listened to some of their stories, and I listened to the reasons they give. Now, I'm not pretending that I've heard every story out there, even though most of them have certain themes that they go by. I haven't heard every story, but the ones that I've heard, I have never heard one story give reasons for their deconversion that had anything to do with who Jesus is. and what he stood for. I've heard all kinds of reasons, but most of them, I sit back and go, well, wait a minute, I don't even believe in that God. The first century Christians didn't even practice these things that you find so offensive. So I want to try to shed some light, maybe a little bit, on some of the reasons maybe that you're faltering in your faith or your friends or family are kind of moving away from faith. And maybe just shed a little bit of light to give you more information, maybe help you a little bit to see it may very well be that the God you're refusing really wasn't the God that we know. And maybe you're refusing some things that maybe are not what Jesus stood for and who he was, what he was about to begin with. So when you look at the atheist 2.0, the tenets that are part of that, there are six of them. Number one, an illusion of self. An illusion of self. It kind of goes like this. If there is no God, then there is no you. Now, I don't mean the physical body you. I can see you all there. My vision's still pretty good. I can see you physically. That's not what I'm talking about. When I say there is no you, there's no you that makes up who you are on the inside. There's no mind. There's a brain. We can see the brain. But we can't measure. We can't see your mind. We can't see your thoughts. We can't see your emotions. We can't see your personality. We can't see your spirit. We can't see your intuition. The things that make up you, the things that make you uniquely you, that make you different from the person sitting beside you. There is none of that. If there is no God, then there are none of all of those things are simply an illusion. Because if there is no God and we live in a world that's only governed by biology, chemistry, and physics, then we're just a bunch of bodies. Everything else that makes up who you are on the inside is just an illusion. We're just a bunch of biology. There's no you, there's no Scott, it's just biology. In fact, Christopher Hitchens, he eventually passed away. He was diagnosed with esophageal cancer. And in 2011, he died from complications related to that. But because he was a journalist, he wanted to chronicle the days leading up to his death. And eventually it was published in a book called Mortality. But as he was chronicling these different things about his life and leading up to his death, he talked about how the doctors would come in. You probably heard doctors say things like this. The doctors would come in and say, you know, Christopher, your body is fighting. Or your body is not, you know, responding well to the treatment. And finally, he writes this in his book, finally he had to look at the doctors. And he made this statement. He said, I don't have a body. I am a body. And that's exactly right. If there is no God, he's saying what should be very clear. I don't have a body like there's some other part of me that's separate from this. It's not like Christopher, and here's my body. It's like, I'm just a body. There's no other part of me than this body. And if there is no God, then that's absolutely right. It's just biology. There's no me. There's no you. There's no things that make us who we are on the inside. Now, think for a moment. I just want you to imagine for a moment trying to live that way. Everybody's just biology. In fact, I want you to do an experiment. Well, this week, I want you to try to live like everything is just biology. That your biology, your spouse's biology, your kids are little biologies. You work with a whole bunch of knucklehead biologies. Just try to live that way. It's unlivable. It's really, really difficult to just look at people like bodies, and that's it. Without seeing different aspects of who they are and what make them unique. But if there's no God, then there's nothing that's measurable beyond our body and we have to resort to. It's just biology. Because there's nothing else. It's just an illusion. The second tenet is the illusion of free will. See, in a universe that's governed by physics, there's no such thing as free will. You might have experienced choosing the person that you married, But you didn't really have a choice. It was already determined. All these things, it's called determinism. All these things have been predetermined, and you're just reacting. It's stimulus and response. You're just reacting. You don't really have a choice. Because choice would mean that you have something else about you that's able to make a different choice than what you made. That you have some type of conscious ability to make a choice, and there's no room for that. In a universe that's governed strictly by physics and the laws of nature, that cannot coexist with free will and a free choice. It's already been determined. And while you may experience making some choices, it's an illusion. You didn't really get to make a choice. You had no choice. Now, Stephen Hawking, brilliant mind, an avowed determinist, he talked about it this way. And again, I think it's just kind of tongue-in-cheek, but here's what he said. I've noticed that even people who claim that everything is predetermined and that we can do nothing to change it look before they cross the road. Why is that? Because there's something so ingrained in us to feel like, man, there's something more to me than just a body, and there's something more to me than just predetermined choices, that I have something, I have a conscious ability to make a choice. There's something ingrained in us that if we were to sit back and go, I'm just a body, it's hard to live that way. See, if you decided this week, I'm going to just live like every choice has already been predetermined, and that every person is just a body, if all of a sudden you started living on a consistent basis like that, and you treat everybody as just a body, pretty soon you're going to be locked up by some of those biologies, and you'll lose the freedom you never really had anyway. So that's going to happen to you because it's unlivable. But if there is no God, then it's just an illusion that you have free choice, free will. The third thing, the illusion of value. The illusion of value. See, value is something we all talk about, something we all believe in. But how do you measure it? How do you measure it? If I were to bring a box of value out here, what's going to be in it? Nothing. But we believe in it. We believe in the value of money. We believe in the value of people. We believe in the value of hard work. We believe in the value of exercising, eating healthy. We believe in the value of time. Value is something that we believe in, that we talk about all the time. But it's just an illusion because we can't measure it. In a world governed by physics and chemistry and biology, you can't measure value. So value is just an illusion. And the reason that it's such, you know, the reason you can't measure it is because value, there's no such thing as actual value. If there was actual value, we can measure it. There's only ascribed value. There's only value of what we place the value on. Okay, so like I've got two pieces of paper up here. One says $20 on it. The other one's just a piece of paper. Now, if I were to ask you, which one of these would you want? And most of you are probably not going to go, I need some scribble pad. Most of you are going to take the 20. Why? They're both pieces of paper. We have ascribed value to this piece of paper over this piece of paper. There's no actual value that we can measure. It's only ascribed value. Where do we get that? How do we determine value? How do we reach beyond ourselves to determine arbitrary value of things? I had some time away this summer, and if I were to tell you right now, one of the things that I wanted to do with my time away is I wanted to drive 8 hours from here to a rural town in Alabama called Creola and sit around with a 77-year-old woman and a 76-year-old man in the hot heat in Alabama on a swing. You would go, okay, that's interesting. I'm not sure why you'd want to do that. I mean, that's a crazy kind of thought. You know, why? There's no value in that. But then what if I told you that that woman and that man is my mom and dad? Well, then you go, okay, yeah, that'd be great. I see the value in that. Why? Because we ascribe value to people, to relationships. Where does that come from? You can't measure it. How do we get any sense of value? And see, where that really comes into play is with things like justice. We all believe in justice. We all want justice, especially when something's been done to us. But how in the world do we arrive at justice? How can we as biologies reach outside of our biology to some arbitrary, invisible thing called justice and apply it to other biologies and hold them accountable to it? Where does that come from? You can't measure it. You know, there's kind of a common thing in our society right now for people to say, like, about truth. I have my truth. You have your truth. I won't impose my truth on you. You don't impose your truth on me. Live by your truth. I live by my truth. And that may or may not work with truth. I don't know of any sane person that will ever say that about justice. I have my justice. You have your justice. Don't impose your justice on me. I won't impose my justice on you. We're not going to say that because if something happens to us, we want people held accountable. We want justice to be served. But when there's no God, there's no sense of value. There's no sense of what people ought do or ought not do. There's no way to hold them accountable to something that they can't measure or see. So value is just an illusion. It's not real. The next three tenets are maybe tenets that you've heard about, or maybe as you've come along with atheism, some things you've heard about related to atheism, so that some of them are going to maybe be a little bit familiar. The fourth tenet is something came from nothing. This is the great mystery, right? It's the question of what happened before the Big Bang. Well, nothing happened before the Big Bang. Well, what? Because before is a time element, and there was no time before the Big Bang. Once the Big Bang happened, and time and space and matter, all of that came into laws of nature, laws of gravity, laws of physics, they all came into play. But before that, there was nothing. But when the Big Bang happened, now there was something. So nothing made something. And now here we are, millions of years later. But we still don't know why things exist. Why was there a Big Bang? How did it even happen, and why did it happen? Those questions are still unanswered, which is why Richard Dawkins, in his book, The God Delusion, he said this. He said, cosmology is waiting for its Darwin. In other words, just as Charles Darwin espoused the theories of natural selection and evolution and gives an explanation of how things came about and came into being, he's saying that cosmology, why we even exist, why the Big Bang even happened, all of those things are still waiting on someone to offer some plausible hypothesis or explanation as to why we're here and why we exist. But right now, if I believe there's no God, I believe that something came from nothing. The fifth thing. First life emerged from no life. That out of no life, out of inanimate objects, life emerged. Life began to take place. Life began to take form. And it started with little single cell organisms, and it branched out and it grew to multiple cell organisms, and then eventually to, you know, people like us. But it all started from, you know, life all emerged from nothing, from no life, from inanimate objects. It all came into being. Francis Collins, geneticist, and he talks about, he says in his book, out of no life emerged the digital elegance of DNA. That from nothing, you know, you look at the geneticists are discovering more and more about our bodies and about DNA, that every single cell in your body has intricate levels of DNA and has so much information that they're still trying to discover all the information that one cell in your body has on it. And all of that was formed from some inanimate nothing to the complex bodies that we have today. may be true. And if there's no God, you're left to believe those kinds of things. And then the last thing, the sixth thing is this. Natural selection is responsible for all life after first life. So once first life came into place, then natural selection has been responsible for everything since then, for all the variations that you see, all the varieties of people and organisms that you see, for all the years past, that natural selection has caused all of those things to take place. In fact, Richard Dawkins was talking about this in his book, The God Delusion. And I want to read this to you. And when you hear it, you're going to think, is he making fun of natural selection and evolution? Because it just sounds like, what in the world? But I think what he's doing is trying to use some creative way to explain what happened through natural selection in a way that everybody would go, wow, that's cool. But just listen to what he says, trying to explain natural selection. He says, think about it. On one planet, and possibly only one planet in the entire universe, molecules that would normally make nothing more complicated than a chunk of rock gathered themselves together into chunks of rock-sized matter in such staggering complexity that they are capable of running, jumping, swimming, flying, seeing, hearing, capturing, and eating other such animated chunks of complexity, capable in some cases of thinking, feeling, and falling in love with yet other chunks of complex matter. And you read that and you go, is he kidding? I mean, because it sounds like you got like a rock and a rock came together, another rock, and here we are. You know, I mean, it's like, what in the world? But it's trying to explain this invisible force called natural selection that has brought about the varieties and the variations of all that we see around us. And you know, as I've read and studied and looked at a lot of this stuff, in fact, the IT group was working on my computer this past week, and I was standing there with him, and he was looking at my history page, and it was just filled with atheism stuff and all this kind of stuff. And he looked at me, are you thinking about going to heaven? No, I'm speaking on it this week. He's like, okay, all right. But as I'm looking at all these things, and I'm looking at the things, you know, related to natural selection. And again, I'm not smart as these guys who are talking about it. I own my ignorance. I have a doctorate in theology, not biology, okay? So I own my ignorance. I'll say that up front. But as I look at them talking in the descriptions about natural selection, it seems like every description is loaded with characteristics of this personal, agenda-driven, unstoppable, can't put it out of business force that is molding and shaping the varieties of everything we see, including people. And to think that it's just some inanimate thing. If there's no God, that's what it is. But boy, it sure sounds like God to me. Now, you may sit here today and you say, well, Scott, I'm not wanting to be atheist. I don't even believe a lot of those things. And I can see what you're saying. It'd be hard to live like some of those things. But if I'm being honest, I have lost faith, or I'm losing faith in God. Or maybe you'd say I have friends or family members that have lost faith or are losing faith in God, if I'm being honest. And what I would suggest to you is that possibly the God that you're losing faith in never truly existed. That, if I can be so arrogant, that maybe you believed in the wrong God. And I'm going to talk about more of that next week. That we get sold on different ideas of what God is and who God is and what he's like. And along the way, maybe it leads to some unsettling conclusions. And we walk away from a God that never really existed to begin with. that was the wrong God to begin with. And so hopefully over the next 3 weeks, I'll be able to shed a little bit of light on some of those reasons and some of those things that take us away from who the true God really is. You know, it may very well be that all of our choices are predetermined and that we have no real choice and no real freedom of will. It may be true. It may be true that we really don't have value. That you know, you don't have any value, and your spouse doesn't have any value, and your children, they don't have any value, and your coworkers, they don't have any value. All those things may be true. It may very well be an illusion. It may be true. It may be true that there's really no such thing as justice. There's no such thing as this invisible thing out here that we can reach to hold people accountable to. Maybe that that's just an illusion. But here's what I believe about most of us in this room. While that might be true, all those things, we hope it's not true. We hope that it's not true. We hope that there's more than that. That there's more to us than that. I hope that there's more to us than those kinds of things. But see, that kind of hope only comes from a God of hope. That kind of hope is placed in us. And while we might be drawn away and have unsettling conclusions, and we might be thinking, I don't know if I can believe, we hope that it's real. There's something in us that yearns to know that it's real, that God is real, that He loves us, that He created us, that He wants a relationship. There's something in us that hopes. As strongly as we want to stand against it at times, there's something in us that cries out and hopes that it's true. The Apostle Paul, he was talking to a group of Stoic philosophers in Athens, Greece. And the Apostle Paul was one of the most educated men in his culture. And these Stoic philosophers were questioning the whole validity of God and the resurrection. And so Paul stands before them and gives a defense for God and who God is. And in Acts chapter 17, I just want to read this to you. In Acts chapter 17, here's what he says. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by human hands. And He is not served by human hands as if He needed anything. Rather, He Himself gives everyone life and breath and everything else. From one man He made all the nations that they should inhabit the whole earth. And He marked out their appointed times in history and the boundaries of their lands. God did this. He had an agenda. God did this so that they would seek Him and perhaps reach out for Him and find Him, though He is not far from any one of us. For in Him we live and move and have our being. See, the Apostle Paul was convinced that what your heart is crying out for is this God that created you. And He had a purpose in all the things that He's done so that you would reach out and find Him, and He's not far from you. Though you might feel like you're far from God, He's never far from you. And if you really want to know where meaning and purpose and all the things that we want to be a part of our life, where they come from, it's in this God who causes us to live and move and breathe and have our being. So who needs God? Apostle Paul would say, we all do. We all do. And next week, we're going to talk about some of the gods that we wind up believing in that are really not true gods. I hope you'll come back and be a part of it. I hope it's a life-changing series for you. Let me pray for us, okay? God, thank You so much for all You do to show Yourself to us, to make Yourself known to us. God, it's that the truth is that You're not far from any of us. That it doesn't matter how far we go and how far down a road away from You we feel like we've traveled, that when we turn, You're right there. And God, I pray for anyone who's here today that says, I don't know, I just, I, I just don't know if I believe. I just lost that belief or that faith. God, I pray that you would just begin shedding light in their heart and just drawing them back to you. I understand and believe that there's not a person in this room that you don't love, that you haven't created specifically for a purpose. God, I pray that you'd begin to make that clear. Help us to know more about you as we travel through this series. Thank you for all you do to show yourself to us. And we pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.